And we're back. We return to the United Nations General Assembly's general debate. On Saturday, the speaker's list included the Foreign Minister of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, also known as North Korea, Minister Ri Yong-ho.
Excellency President, first of all, allow me to congratulate Your Excellency Maria Fernanda Espinosa Garces on your election as the President of the 73rd session of the UN General Assembly. I look forward to successful outcome of the UNGA under your able stewardship. Madam President, peace and development is a common desire of our times, and it constitutes the main objective of the UN defining all its activities. Many countries around the world concentrate their efforts on achieving peace and development, but such efforts are still faced with serious challenges. During the past 1 year, we have been witnessing the overall international relations becoming tense, with peace being threatened and development being deterred in many parts of the world due to the power-does-it-all attitude of unilateralism, and such a situation requires even more enhanced role of the UN. It is the Korean Peninsula where the most tangible trend of peace and development was newly created this year. In April this year, Comrade Kim Jong-un, the chairman of the State Affairs Commission of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, put forward a new strategic line of concentrating all efforts on the socialist economic construction. Since we have sufficiently consolidated national defense capabilities and war deterrence to cope with the nuclear threats against the DPRK that have been lasting for over several decades, concentrating all efforts on economic construction has come up to us as a historic task. The DPRK government's policy line of focusing on the economy requires peaceful environment above anything else. Comrade Chairman Kim Jong-un conducted energetic summit-level diplomatic activities with a firm determination to turn the Korean Peninsula into a land of peace, free of both nuclear weapons and nuclear threats, and made an important breakthrough in improving the North-South relations and the DPRK-US relations, and in revitalizing the friendly and cooperative relations with neighboring countries, and thus made a turning point for dramatic easing of tension in the Korean Peninsula. As much as we have achieved in easing of tension in the Korean Peninsula and its region, the peace and security of the region will be consolidated, and this will lead to the world peace and security, to the benefits of all the member states of the UN, in other words. The fact that representatives of numerous countries have been unanimous in supporting and welcoming the current direction of the developments in the Korean Peninsula at this platform clearly shows that the DPRK government's strategic choice and its sincere efforts to pursue that policy choice fully concur with the common interest and desire of the international community. Madam President, the key to consolidating the peace and security in the Korean Peninsula is to thoroughly implement the DPRK-US joint statement adopted in June at the historic DPRK-US summit in Singapore. The DPRK-US joint statement contains all principled issues regarding eventual solutions of the issues in the Korean Peninsula, such as terminating decades-long hostility between the two countries and establishing new DPRK-US relations, building solid peace regime on the Korean Peninsula, realizing complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and humanitarian work between the two countries. Once the DPRK-US joint statement is implemented, the current trend towards détente will turn into durable peace, and the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula will also be achieved, and the Korean Peninsula, the hottest spot in the globe, will become the cradle of peace and prosperity that contributes to security in Asia and the rest of the world. The DPRK government's commitment to thorough implementation of the DPRK-US joint statement is unwavering. the primary task for effectively implementing the DPRK-US joint statement should be bringing down the barrier of mistrust between the two countries, which has existed for several decades. And to this end, the DPRK and US should spend many efforts to building trust above all. All the past process for the implementation of previous agreements between from various dialogues and negotiations between the DPRK and US ended in failure because the mistrust between the two was not sufficiently removed, resulting in lack of confidence. It is our position that the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula should also be realized along with building peace regime under the principle of simultaneous actions, step by step, starting with what we can do and giving priority to trust building. Out of the desire and resolute determination to successfully implement the DPRK-US joint statement, the DPRK government gives particular attention to trust building and is pouring primary efforts to this. Even before the DPRK-US summit, the DPRK government took significant goodwill measures such as stopping nuclear and ICBM tests, dismantling the nuclear test site in a transparent manner, and affirming not to transfer nuclear weapons and nuclear technology under any circumstances. And it continues to put in efforts to trust building. However, we do not see any corresponding response from the U.S. On the contrary, instead of addressing our concern for the absence of peace regime in the Korean Peninsula, the U.S. insists on the denuclearization first and increases the level of pressure by sanctions to achieve their purpose in a coercive manner, and even objecting the declaration of the end of war. The perception that sanctions can bring us on our knees is a pipe dream of the people who are ignorant about us. But the problem is that the continued sanctions are deepening our mistrust. The reason behind the recent deadlock is because the U.S. relies on coercive methods which are lethal to trust building. The recent dramatic improvement of the North-South relations and the atmosphere of cooperation clearly show how decisive the role of trust building can be. In less than 5 months, the leaders of the North and the South met 3 times, and through their meetings and talks, they have been building trust in each other enough for solving the various issues in the North-South relations in a constructive manner, and the tangible results are shown in reality. As demonstrated by the September Pyongyang Joint Declaration that was jointly announced by the leaders of the North and the South on September 19 this year, the dialogues between the North and South in many areas, including the fields of politics, military, humanitarian work, sports, culture, and economic cooperation, are very active. An atmosphere of reconciliation and cooperation has been high like never before, and many noteworthy outcomes are being made one after another, enjoying the support and welcome by the entire Korean nation and the international community. If the party to this issue of denuclearization were South Korea and not the U.S., the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula would not have come to such a deadlock. This is why we give great importance to building confidence between the DPRK and the U.S. for the implementation of the joint statement. Without any trust in the U.S., there will be no confidence in our national security, and under such circumstances, there is no way we will unilaterally disarm ourselves first. The DPRK government's commitment to the denuclearization is solid and firm. However, it is only possible if the U.S. secures our sufficient trust towards the U.S. Madam President, there are pessimistic views towards the implementation of the DPRK-US joint statement inside the U.S., and that is not because there is any flaw in the joint statement, but because of the U.S. domestic politics. those in the political opposition in the U.S. make it their daily business to slander the DPRK, claiming that we cannot be trusted with the sole purpose of attacking their political opponent. And they are enforcing the administration to make unreasonable unilateral demand to our side, thereby impeding the smooth progress of the dialogue and negotiations, creating mistrust towards the dialogue partner while only relying on coercive method is not helpful at all in building trust. On the contrary, it only increases mistrust. Talking about reasons for distrusting each other, we have far more reasons to distrust the U.S. The U.S. possessed nuclear weapons earlier than we did, and the U.S. is the only country that actually used them in real war. From the very first day of our republic 70 years ago, the U.S. has exercised hostile policy against our country and put complete economic blockade against our country, making sure that the U.S. enterprises cannot even trade a single screwnail with our country. We did not even throw a pebble stone at the U.S. soil, but during the Korean War, the U.S. threatened to drop tens of atomic bombs in our country. And even after that, the U.S. kept bringing in strategic nuclear arsenals at our doorsteps. If the both countries harbor mistrust towards each other, being obsessed with the past, then the recent DPRK-U.S. joint statement cannot escape the same fate of failure as all the previous agreements between the two countries. One part of the spirit of the DPRK-US summit in Singapore is to free ourselves of old conventional way and trying a completely new way of solving the issues. At this critical juncture, the U.S. should make a foresighted judgment that faithful fulfillment of the commitment it made in Singapore will, in the end, be in the best national interest of the U.S. and should maintain new method for solving the DPRK-U.S. relations. Only then there will be a positive prospect for the DPRK-U.S. joint statement. If the DPRK-U.S. joint statement becomes a victim of the domestic politics of the U.S., then the greatest victim of the subsequent unpredictable consequences will be the U.S. itself as a whole. Solving the DPRK-U.S. relations and issues in the Korean Peninsula is the key topic in achieving the theme of this session, making the United Nations relevant to all people, global leadership, and shared responsibilities for peaceful, equitable, and sustainable societies. Our new policy line of concentrating all efforts on the economic construction is the right political choice, not only in improving our people's life, but also in realizing the common desire of the people around the world aspiring after peace and development. The international society should support and encourage our efforts to focus on the economic construction in response to the bold decisions and goodwill measures we have taken for the easing of tension and maintaining durable peace in the Korean Peninsula. The implementation of the DPRK joint statement is a shared responsibility of the DPRK and the U.S. At the same time, the U.N. also has a role to play in it. The U.N. Security Council that was once so eager to express concern to the tense situation in the Korean Peninsula keeps silence even now about the precious momentum for peace in the Korean Peninsula, which has been achieved this year. This cannot be said as normal in any way. The UNSC poured down on us numerous sanctions resolutions making issue of our nuclear tests and rocket test launches. But even today, when one whole year has passed since such tests have been stopped, even a word in those resolutions remains unchanged, to say nothing about being totally removed or eased. Worse still, the UNSC is taking very concerning stand by rejecting the proposal by some of its member states to issue presidential statement that welcomes the DPRK-US summit and the joint statement. The UN command in South Korea even showed alarming signs of hindering the implementation of the Panmunjom Declaration between the North and South. As for the UN command, it is merely a command of allied forces beyond the control of the UN that only obeys the orders of the US. But the problem is that it is still misusing the sacred name of the UN. Based on the mission of the UN as defined in the UN Charter, the UN and especially the UNSC have the responsibility and duty to support and welcome the developments that are helpful in ensuring international peace and security. The UN should really apply the theme of this session, making the United Nations relevant to all people, global leadership and shared responsibilities, to its actual activities, and hence get rid of the stigma that UNSC equals U.S. as early as possible. Thank you.
Also on Saturday, Syria's Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualim spoke to the assembled members of the General Assembly.
Madam President of the 73rd session of the United Nations, I would like to congratulate you and your country, Ecuador, on your election as President of the current session of the General Assembly. And I wish you all the success. I would also like to thank your predecessor for presiding over the Assembly during the previous session. I would also like to thank His Excellency, the Secretary General of the United Nations, for his effort in line with the UN Charter. Madam President, ladies and gentlemen, every year we arrive at this important international forum, we carry so many hopes that every corner of this world would become more secure, stable, and prosperous. Today, our hope is stronger than ever, and so is our confidence that the will of the people shall eventually reign. Our hope and confidence are the result of more than 7 years of hardship, during which our people suffered from the scourge of terrorism. However, Syrians refused to compromise to this terrorism. They refused to succumb to terrorist groups and their external supporters. They stood their ground, they remained defiant, fully convinced that this was a battle for their existence, their history, and their future, and that they will ultimately emerge victorious. To the disappointment of some, here we are today, more than 7 years into this dirty war against my country, announcing to the world that the situation on the ground has become more secure and stable, and that our battle against terrorism is almost over, thanks to the heroism, resolve, and unity of the people and the army, and to the support of our allies and friends. However, we will not stop at these achievements. We remain committed to fighting the sacred battle until we purge all Syrian territories from terrorist groups, regardless of their names, and purge it from any illegal foreign presence. We will pay no heed to any attacks or external pressure, lies or allegations that seek to discourage us. This is our duty and a non-negotiable right that we have exercised as we set out to eradicate terrorism from most of Syria. Madam President, the governments of certain countries have denied us our right under international law and our national duty to combat terrorism and protect our people on our land and within our own borders. At the same time, these governments formed an illegitimate international coalition led by the United States on the pretext of combating terrorism in Syria. The so-called international coalition has done everything but fight terrorism. It has even become clear that the coalition's goals were in perfect alignment with those of terrorist groups, spreading chaos, death, and destruction in their path. The coalition destroyed the Syrian city of Raqqa completely. It destroyed infrastructure and public services in the areas it targeted. It has also committed massacres against civilians, including children and women, which amount to war crimes under international law. The coalition has also provided direct military support to terrorists on multiple occasions as they fought against the Syrian army. It should have been more aptly named the Coalition to Support Terrorists and War Crimes. The situation in Syria and its dimensions cannot be divorced from the battle raging between two camps on the world stage. One of the camps promotes peace, stability, and prosperity across the world, advocates for dialogue and mutual understanding, respects international law, and upholds the principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of other states, while the other camp tries to spread chaos in international relations and insists on employing colonization and hegemony as tools to further its narrow interests, even if that meant resorting to corrupt methods such as supporting terrorism and imposing an economic blockade to subjugate people and governments that reject external dictates and insist on making their own independent national decisions. What happened in Syria should have been a lesson to some countries, but those countries refuse to learn. They heeded with deaf ears. They chose to bury their heads in the sand. This is why, ladies and gentlemen, we, the members of this organization, must make a clear and unequivocal choice. Are we going to defend international law and the UN Charter and be on the side of justice? Or are we going to submit to hegemonic tendencies and the law of the jungle that some are trying to impose on this organization and the world? Ladies and gentlemen, today the situation on the ground is more stable and secure thanks to progress made in combating terrorism. The government continues to rehabilitate the areas destroyed by terrorists to restore normalcy. All conditions are now present for the voluntary return of Syrian refugees to the country they had to leave because of terrorism and the unilateral economic measures that targeted their daily lives and their livelihoods. True enough, thousands of Syrian refugees abroad have started the journey back home. From this podium, I would like to stress the following. The return of each and every Syrian refugee is a priority for the Syrian state. Doors are wide open for all Syrians abroad to return voluntarily and safely. And what applies to Syrians inside Syria also applies to Syrians abroad. No one is above the law. Thanks to the help of Russia, the Syrian government will spare no effort to facilitate the return of those refugees and meet their basic needs. Therefore, a special committee was recently established to coordinate the return of refugees to their places of origin in Syria and to help them regain their lives once again. We have called upon the international community and humanitarian organizations to facilitate these returns. However, some Western countries, and in line with their dishonest behavior since the start of the war in Syria, continue to prevent the return of refugees. They are spreading irrational fears among refugees. They are politicizing what should be a purely humanitarian issue, using refugees as a bargaining chip to serve their political agenda and linking the return of refugees to the political process. Today, as we are about to close the last chapter in the crisis, Syrians are determined to come together and erase the traces of this terrorist war and to rebuild their country with their own hands, whether they stayed in Syria or were forced to leave due to the terrorist acts. We welcome any assistance with reconstruction from those countries or entities that were not part of the aggression on Syria and those that have come out clearly and explicitly against terrorism. However, the priority in the reconstruction of Syria would be given to our friends that stood by us in our war on terror. As for the countries that offer only conditional assistance or continue to support terrorism, they are neither invited nor welcome to help in the first place. Madam President, as we move ahead on counterterrorism, reconstruction, and the return of refugees, we remain committed to the political process without compromising on our national principles. These include primarily preserving the sovereignty, independence, and territorial unity of the Syrian Arab Republic, protecting the exclusive right of Syrians to determine the future of their country without any external interference, and eradicating terrorism from our country. Based on the above, we express time and again our readiness to respond to any initiative that would help Syrians end the crisis. We have engaged positively and openly in the Geneva talks, the Astana process, and the Syrian National Dialogue in Sochi. However, it has always been the other parties that set obstacles, that rejected dialogue, and resorted to terrorism and foreign interference to achieve their goals. Nevertheless, we continue to adopt a positive attitude and implement the outcomes of the Sochi Syrian National Dialogue on the formation of a constitutional committee to review the current constitution. We presented a practical and comprehensive vision on the composition, prerogatives, and working methods of the committee, and submitted a list of representatives on behalf of the Syrian state. We stress that the mandate of the committee is limited to reviewing the articles of the current constitution through a Syrian-led and Syrian-owned process that may be facilitated by the special envoy of the Secretary General for Syria. We also stress that no preconditions should be imposed on the committee, nor should its recommendations be prejudged. The committee must be independent, since the Constitution and anything related to it is a Syrian matter to be decided by Syrians themselves. Therefore, we will not accept any proposal that constitutes an interference in the internal affairs of Syria or leads to such interference. We reaffirm that the Syrian people must have the final word regarding any constitutional or sovereign matter. We also reaffirm our readiness to work actively with our friends to convene the committee along the parameters I have just mentioned. In addition to these international initiatives, local reconciliation is well underway. Reconciliation agreements allowed us to stem the bloodshed and prevent destruction in many areas around Syria. They restored stability and a normal life to these areas, which allowed people to return to their homes, those homes that they were forced to leave because of terrorism. Reconciliation, therefore, will remain our priority and our focus. Ladies and gentlemen, the battle we fought in Syria against terrorism was not only a military one. It was also an ideological battle between the culture of destruction, extremism, and death, and the culture of construction, tolerance, and life. Therefore, I launch an appeal from this rostrum, calling for fighting the ideology of terrorism and violent extremism, drawing up its support and financial resources while implementing relevant Security Council resolutions, notably Resolution 2253. The military battle against terrorism, albeit important, is not enough. Terrorism is like an epidemic. It will return, break out, and threaten everyone without exception. Madam President, we fully condemn and reject the use of chemical weapons under any circumstances, wherever it occurs, whenever it occurs, and regardless of the target. This is why Syria eliminated completely its chemical program and fulfilled all its commitments as a member of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, as confirmed by numerous reports issued by the organization. Although some Western countries are constantly trying to politicize the work of the organization, we have always cooperated with the OPCW to the largest extent possible. Unfortunately, every time we express our readiness to receive objective and professional investigative teams to investigate the alleged use of chemical weapons, these countries would block such efforts because they know that the conclusions of the investigations would not satisfy the ill intentions they harbor against Syria. These countries have already made accusations and scenarios to justify an aggression on Syria. This was the case when the United States, France, and the UK launched a tripartite wanton aggression on Syria last April, claiming that chemical weapons were used without any investigation or evidence, and in a flagrant violation of Syria's sovereignty, international law, and the UN Charter. Meanwhile, these same countries disregarded all reliable information we provided on chemical weapons in the possession of terrorist groups that used them on multiple occasions. They were used to blame the Syrian government and justify an attack against it. The terrorist organization known as the White Helmets was the main tool used to mislead public opinion and fabricate accusations and come up with lies on the use of chemical weapons in Syria. The White Helmets that were created by the British intelligence under a humanitarian cover. It has been proven, however, that this organization is part of Al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front. Despite all allegations, we remain committed to liberate all our territory without concern for the black banners of terrorists or the theatrics of their white helmets. Ladies and gentlemen, in another episode of the terrorist war on Syria since 2011, suicide bombings orchestrated by ISIL rocked the governorate of Suwayda in southern Syria last July. It is worth noting that the terrorists behind that attack came from the Tanf area, where U.S. forces are present. The area has become a safe haven for ISIL remnants, those armed groups who are now hiding in the Rukban refugee camp on the border with Jordan, under the protection and sponsorship of U.S. forces present in the area. In line with this investment in terrorism and to prolong the crisis in Syria, the United States also sought to release terrorists from Guantanamo prison and send them to Syria, where they became the effective leaders of the Nusra Front and other terrorist groups. Meanwhile, the Turkish regime continues to support terrorists in Syria. Since day one of the war on Syria, the Turkish regime has trained and armed terrorists, turning Turkey into a hub and a corridor for terrorists on their way to Syria. When terrorists failed to serve the agenda of the Turkish regime, the latter resorted to direct military aggression, attacking so many cities and towns in northern Syria. However, all these actions that aim at undermining Syria's sovereignty, unity, and territorial integrity and violate international law will not stop us from exercising our rights and fulfilling our duties to recover our land and purge it from terrorists, whether through military action or reconciliation agreements. Proceeding from the above, we have always been open to any initiative that prevents further deaths and restores safety and security to areas affected by terrorism. That's why we welcomed the agreement on Idlib reached in Sochi on September the 17th, 2018. The agreement was the result of intensive consultations between Syria and Russia. It resulted from full coordination between the two countries. We reaffirm that this agreement is time-bound, includes clear deadlines, and complements the agreements previously reached on the de-escalation zones, as was provided for in Astana. We hope that when the agreement is implemented, the Nusra Front and other terrorist groups will be eradicated, thus eliminating the last remnants of terrorism in Syria. Any foreign presence on Syrian territory without the consent of the Syrian government is illegal and constitutes a flagrant violation of international law and the UN Charter. It is an assault on our national sovereignty, which undermines counter-terrorism efforts and threaten regional peace and security. We therefore consider any forces operating on Syrian territory without an explicit request from the Syrian government, including US, French, and Turkish forces, occupying forces and will be dealt with accordingly. They must withdraw immediately and without any conditions. Ladies and gentlemen, Israel continues to occupy a dear part of our land in the Syrian Golan, and our people there continue to suffer because of its oppressive and aggressive policies. Israel even supported terrorist groups that operated in southern Syria, protecting them through direct military intervention and launching repeated attacks on Syrian territories. But just as we liberated southern Syria from terrorists, we are determined to liberate fully the occupied Syrian Golan to the lines of June the 4th, 1967. Syria demands that the international community put an end to all these practices and compel Israel to implement relevant UN resolutions, notably Resolution 497 on the occupied Syrian Golan. The international community must also help the Palestinian people establish its own independent state with Jerusalem as its capital and facilitate the return of Palestinian refugees to their land pursuant to international resolutions of international legitimacy. Any actions that undermine these rights are null and void and threaten regional peace and security, especially the Israeli racist law known as the Nation State Law and the decision of the U.S. administration to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and stop funding UNRWA. Syria strongly condemns the decision of the U.S. administration to withdraw from the Iran nuclear agreement, which proves once again the United States' disregard for international treaties and conventions. We express once again our solidarity with the leaders and people of the Islamic Republic of Iran and trust that they will overcome the effects of this irresponsible decision of the U.S. administration. We also stand with the government and people of Venezuela in the face of U.S. attempts to interfere in their internal affairs. We call once again for lifting the unilateral economic measures imposed against the Syrian people and all other independent people around the world, especially the people of the DPRK, Cuba, and Belarus. Madam President, ladies and gentlemen, to conclude, you have to know that with the help of allies and friends, Syria will defeat terrorism. The world must never forget that and should treat us accordingly. It is high time for all those detached from reality to wake up, let go of their fantasies, and come to their senses, see matters realistically, They must realize that they will not achieve politically what they failed to achieve by force. We have never compromised on our national principles, even when the war was at its peak. We will surely not do that today. At the same time, we want peace for the people of the world. That's the message we carry, because we want peace for our people. We have never attacked others. We have never interfered in the affairs of others. We have never exported terrorism to other parts of the world. We have always maintained the best relations with other countries. Today, as we seek to defeat terrorism, we continue to advocate dialogue and mutual understanding to serve the interests of our people and to achieve security, stability, and prosperity for all. Thank you very much.
This past Friday, Iraq's Foreign Minister, Ibrahim Abdul Karim al-Jaafari, addressed the General Assembly. The following is his statement in its entirety.
In the name of God, the Merciful and the Compassionate. August Assembly, I would like to begin by conveying to you my warmest greetings, and I convey those greetings in the name of God, the Merciful and the Compassionate, and the same God who, according to the Quran, is the sustainer of man on earth. To Her Excellency Ms. Maria Fernanda Espinosa Garces, President of the General Assembly, His Excellency Mr. Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, Your Royal Highnesses, Your Majesties, Your Excellencies, may the peace of Allah be with you. President, it is my pleasure at the outset of this statement to congratulate you personally upon your election to the presidency of the 73rd session of the United Nations General Assembly. I wish you every success in the discharge of your duties in that role. I would like also to express publicly my gratitude to your predecessor, Mr. Miroslav Lajček, who so very ably and wisely steered the work of the preceding session, the 72nd. 4 years ago, and from this very same podium, I shared with you an overview of the situation in a country where Daesh had occupied a third of the territory, and Daesh had burned the land in its wake. It had killed, it had pulled down the mausoleums of the prophets and other artifacts of culture. It had expelled 6 million Iraqis from the provinces that it had taken over. It preyed upon minorities. It ravaged women. It expelled Turkmens. It killed men. It killed Shiite Turkmen women from the regions it seized. It burned some of them alive. This could have been a historic catastrophe from which we would never have recovered. Despair had seized the hearts and minds of many. But there were still plenty of us of Iraqis who were full of faith in God, who had full faith in the determination of our young people, of our women, of our leaders, to turn things around. We had full faith in all Iraqis, of all faiths, of all ethnicities, and that faith was duly repaid because they rose up to defend their country. Blood was shed on the field of battle to liberate the territory of Iraq, and a huge sacrifice was paid for that liberation. The fight left thousands of martyrs and amongst our armed forces and left scores more injured. And not just the members of our armed forces, but also those from the People's Mobilization Units and from the police, from the many clans and tribes who also answered the call to battle against Daesh. And so we were able to stand on the field of honor victorious, thanks to the support of the United Nations, the International Coalition, and indeed the support of our brothers and neighbors from the international community writ large. And so our full gratitude to you. Iraq will never forget all those who stood shoulder to shoulder with them at this bloody and dark hour. This was A key battleground, a deadly battleground at the time when the world itself was under threat, at a time when terrorism had spread to occupy the largest swathe of territory in history. There were fighters in Iraq from some 120 nationalities fighting in the cause of terrorism. But thanks be to God and to the international community, we were able to vanquish this ferocious enemy and to drive it out of Iraq. It is now breathing its last in its last stronghold in Syria before being snuffed out. And now, here, 4 years later, I would like to show you how my country is facing the future, a future of reconstruction, leaving war behind it. What my country is doing to allow displaced persons to return, those displaced persons who were driven out of their homes and scattered to the various corners of the world. We are working hard to strengthen state institutions. And so we're on the dawn of a new chapter in Iraq, joining the Club of Democratic Nations. We are strengthening levels of participation in governance and ensuring that we're building a political and constitutional consensus. We are bringing together persons of all religious and confessional belief around a national effort based on the respect of the law and of the constitution. Most recently, we held legislative elections as part of a cycle of democratic elections that have occurred since 2004, and with each round of elections, we learn more and further embed our democracy. We have a new prime minister who's been appointed by the president, who has been charged with setting up a cabinet and to leading the government for the current mandate, with a chief focus on building prosperity in the nation and stamping out once and for all terrorism. As I'm delivering this speech to you, the people in Kurdistan are preparing for democratic parliamentary elections in line with the multi-party federal system that we have chosen to adopt as our democracy framework in Iraq. I would invite the international community to shoulder its responsibilities borne to Iraq and to make available to Iraq the pledges and monies that were promised to us during the Kuwait conference to disperse said funds. Many pledges were made in Kuwait to support Iraq, and these pledges were made because Iraq is the cradle of civilization and is also a crossroads and a melting pot of different nationalities, religious beliefs, and traditions. We are a motherlode of wealth of many kinds that needs to be exploited and harnessed properly. This is a new era in Iraq's story. And this is also true when it comes to our fight against terrorism. We are engaged in an all-out campaign against the remaining pockets of terrorism to make sure that their ugly faces are no longer seen in our country. We have also an economic, cultural, and political strategic plan in place, because this is not just about stamping out terrorism, but ensuring that we build a robust society that can withstand any scourge or spectre of the return of terrorism. As part of that, we are focusing on young people and women. We are rolling out programs to improve the plight and well-being of young people and women, to improve their living standards, to put an end to levels of unemployment, and to improve their skills base. And this is all part of our efforts under the 2030 agenda. We're also doing all that we can to protect diversity and to maintain peace and security in the recently liberated regions of the country. All of this is part of national reconciliation, which is a huge undertaking, which must also lead into the strengthening of our national institutions. Attempts are being made to ensure that Iraq is held together, and I think that the recent combat and fighting that we saw has only served to strengthen Iraq as a single unique geographical entity and to bring its people further closer together as they stood together to protect their country. They have withstood terrorism and they are pursuing democracy following the election guidelines that were set for us, meeting those deadlines. We're promoting diversity and we're promoting political plurality, particularly in the run-up to upcoming elections. The United Nations has been a strong partner of Iraq, particularly in the guise of UNAMI. United Nations staff have made huge and much appreciated sacrifices. UNAMI has most recently been working to support activities of the Iraqi government as it pursues the aforementioned goals. I would like to underscore the key role played by the special envoy, Mr. Jan Kubic, who has made considerable progress and headway during the time of his mandate. So we thank him as he prepares to leave, and we welcome Ms. Janine Hennis Plengschut, who will be the first female special envoy heading up UNAMI, and we wish her every success in that new role. We wish to put an end once and for all to conflict in Iraq by ensuring that displaced persons can return, by providing compensation and care to those who have suffered, and by collecting proof and evidence of those crimes committed by Daesh. And we will do so through the commission that was set up under Resolution 2379 of the Security Council, resolution adopted in 2017. We remain convinced that the maintenance of peace and security at the international level is a responsibility borne by all of us. It is borne by each and every nation, not just by the members of the Security Council. We wish to underscore and stress the importance of continuing action by the international community to stand together with Iraq, but also to fight more broadly against the proliferation of nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction and ensure that they are eradicated in order to ensure a safe and secure future for upcoming generations. We support the universalization of all disarmament-related conventions. As far as we are concerned, pursuing the provisions of these conventions would ensure a genuine end to armament and ensure that WMDs are never used again. Iraq has paid a heavy price for the use of these weapons, particularly WMDs, during the era of the dictatorship, when the population in Al-Habja suffered one of the most egregious crimes in human history when chemical weapons were used against that town. In Iraq, we have also seen such horrendous acts as arbitrary executions and detentions, to name but a few of the host of human rights violations that took place during the dictatorship. We are doing what we can to improve the economy by making the best possible use of our economic resources, by creating an environment that is favorable to outside investment as part of our drive to ensure that we have a sustainable and resilient economy. We insist upon our position of principle with regard to the Palestinian question. Peace will not be seen in our region without the full withdrawal of Israel, the occupying power, from the Palestinian territories. We call for a complete withdrawal from the Arab and Palestinian territories that are currently occupied by Israel, and we call for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital. We condemn the settlement policy pursued by the occupying power, Israel, which is a violation of all international law. And here Iraq would like to once again categorically reject the step taken of transferring the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. This in no way will serve to further the course of peace in the region. It will instead render the picture yet more complicated and bleak. We reject the blockade that is being imposed on the Palestinian territories, which is outside all United Nations law and resolution. Measures are being taken to punish the government of the Palestinian authorities, and pretexts are being wielded that are unacceptable. Even were they to be acceptable, at the end of the day, it is the people, the ordinary man and woman in the street, who pay the heaviest price for these economic sanctions. The Iraqi people themselves know what they speak of because they spent 13 years under the yoke of sanctions. From 1990 to 2013, and we really suffered as a result of those sanctions. Again, the man and the woman in the street, the ordinary citizen. It affected all levels of society, young, old, those who are of working age, children. This was a veritable sword of Damocles, and therefore it is something that should be wielded very, very carefully and certainly should not be wielded outside the framework of United Nations decision. For that reason, we will not support these blockades and these embargoes that are being leveled against the Palestinian territories. They bode ill, and as I have stressed repeatedly, the price is paid not by those in authority, but by the ordinary man and woman. Turning to security, we believe that security is an indivisible whole. You cannot pursue security in your own borders, paying no attention to the security of your neighbors. So security goes hand in hand with wider geopolitical concerns. Geosecurity is a term that is often overlooked when talking about geopolitical realities. And when dealing with geosecurity, it's not enough to focus on your own needs. You need to make sure that the needs of your neighbors are met as well. We welcome recent developments in the Korean Peninsula that are moving us closer towards the United Nations goal of maintaining and upholding international peace and security. We hope that peace and stability will soon be restored in the Korean Peninsula, putting an end to a cycle of violence. And we hope that the same will be true in Syria, and that the cycle of violence will put an end to in Syria, preserving the territorial integrity of that nation, and that it will take the guise of a balanced political solution that is endorsed by the Syrian government and other stakeholders, a solution that will allow for an end to be put to the bloodbath that has enveloped Syria, and a solution that will put an end to any attempt to push towards a military solution which cannot be successful in Syria. This is why we recommend to the political stakeholders and parties to work seriously towards such a solution, a political rather than a military one. Turning to Yemen, here again, we believe that a solution can only be found through peaceful dialogue. The conflict must come to an end, the guns of war must be silenced, and all external meddling must also cease. We categorically reject the presence of Turkish forces in Bashiqa, and we reject any violation of Iraqi sovereignty. Our aspiration is good and peaceful relations with Turkey, who is our neighbor, peaceful relations as we enjoy with other neighboring countries. But that said, we call upon Turkey to take a clear stance in response to these violations, recognize them as violations, and put an end to them. We also call for the restoration to Iraq of our water resources, because the loss of these resources has reduced the level in the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, the water levels, which has led to an adverse environmental and economic impact, which will have serious repercussions for the future. The civilization of Mesopotamia flourished on the banks of these two rivers, and it is there that the first civilizations emerged in human history, there in the south of Iraq, on the banks of the Euphrates and Tigris. So we feel a double responsibility and duty to preserve not just these water resources, but what is part of human heritage. We reject the statements made by the High Minister of the Zionist Entity, who claimed that Iranian forces were in Iraq and used that to justify an attack on Iraqi sovereignty. We reject any attempt to use the United Nations podium before the General Assembly to undermine the stability of any country. We have worked very hard recently to build close relationships with all our neighboring countries. We have sought to turn the tide of polarization and to be a good neighbor and to enjoy good neighbors. We have not joined in any of the international coalitions, seeking instead to stand alone as a bridge between nations of different views and stakeholders of different views, as such a bridge and as such a hub in our region, so that there can be understanding which will lead to security in our region. We will remain a cradle of religious and cultural and ethnic diversity. Iraq, as has been said, is the birthplace of the world, and whoever controls Iraq controls the four winds of the world. Iraq will never be destroyed. Iraq is a nation that will withstand crisis and brutality. We are proud of our society and our history, and that is indeed true not just in the country, but also in Baghdad as well. As our poet Jamal Eddin said, Baghdad is the repository of our hearts. You will remain resplendent as the centuries go by. You will shine under the sun. The moon will overshine over you. And thanks to your resilience, you will withstand any adversity. May the peace of Allah be upon you all. Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.